Season 4, baby! That's a lot less annoying, true.
We just recorded an intro and I said, okay, let's try something way less annoying. And,
and my ear was like, what I can think of off the top of my head, Season 4, baby! And she's right, it is Season 4, baby.
It's been a freaking while. I think the last time we recorded was August 2023.
Is that 6 months? No.
That's actually yes. fucked up. Yes.
Yes. It is. It is. And the thing is, the reason we haven't recorded is that we got into this huge falling out and we didn't talk for 6 months. And
then
we decided to reconcile for you guys.
Last week.
Yeah. And so just if you sense a bit of tension, it's because we still have some things to work through.
The falling out was that Hannah tried to kill me in my sleep.
Yeah. But in my defense, Maia kept walking around the house saying, if you don't kill me in my sleep, it's gonna be you. and I am dressed like a Chucky doll today.
Yeah, Hannah came into the bathroom about 10 minutes ago and she walked at me with like her arms completely stiff and she was like looking, you know when people look down and then look up, like their heads are turned down but they're looking up with their eyes? That's what she did, and she was not thinking about doing it. She just did it like inherently in a way that was extremely discomforting.
Like, you look like a child killer. And then I thought she meant like someone who kills children, but she meant the other kind.
Yeah, a child who kills
people.
Yeah, that is your general aura.
A murderous child.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Just kidding.
That's why I'm still single.
And that's why she's still down. I'm kidding. So what have we been up to these past few months?
We've been here, there, and everywhere. Maia was living in New York.
I went and lived in New York for 2.5 months. Hannah, while I was gone, told everyone in Toronto that I had officially just fully moved away from Toronto.
Because in my defense, I thought that was what was happening.
So then I came back and everyone was like, I thought you left. And no one seemed that excited to see me, nor that sad that I left. But every single person I've seen has been like, I thought you moved away. And I didn't. I'm back in Toronto.
I know. And the city's worse for it.
Yeah, probably. So, lots of stuff's going on right now. The Oscars
haven't happened yet, but
they're going to. And we're thinking about them.
We're thinking about them. We've been watching movies. I accidentally have seen a lot of movies that are nominated for Best Picture because I decided that it should be a cool thing that I go to the movies a lot.
Yeah, trying to go to the movies more. Going to see The Sweet East tonight is my plan. And currently, I still have American Fiction and Maestro to watch for the Best Picture nominees, but I honestly think I can just skip Maestro. I don't think I need to see that shit.
Yeah, it sounds like the not fun kind of bad.
Well, it's like, they made Tar, and then they made Maestro. Mm. And like, one of those is not the same.
This is so embarrassing. I haven't seen Tar, even though it's a movie I should have seen.
I don't think it's embarrassing, but I think your life is worse for the fact that you have not seen it.
I know. It was because I think I was busy the day everyone went to see it, and then I never did it.
That movie had me gobsmacked. I simply was, my mouth was open the whole time. I was like, ah!
She was like, ah!
Taylor Swift.
What about her?
Hannah has Taylor Swift fatigue, and I think that this is important to report.
Well, now I'm embarrassed that, like, there are episodes you'll start where I'm, like, literally losing my mind about Taylor Swift tickets in Toronto. Didn't get them. So I will not be seeing that show, but I feel bad because the culture seems to be getting tired of her, and I'm like, me too, a little. It's too much. Like, the Super Bowl was last night, and Hillary Clinton literally tweeted, like, congrats to Taylor's boyfriend and the rest of the Chiefs. Justin Trudeau tweeted at Taylor Swift to come to, like, it's like, if you're, like, a liberal politician, like, that's what the level that Taylor Swift is on now. She's, like, a unifying force.
It's so
that you're trying to appeal to everyone, and it's annoying. And her new album, that is the worst title I've ever heard for anything ever, which I appreciate. I appreciate how stupid the title is.
What's the title?
Her new album's going to be called The Tortured Poets Department.
Oh, that's what people were referring to. Yeah. I didn't watch the Grammys. I won't lie. I'm not that interested. But
I didn't either.
But that is really funny. I thought she had said that in her speech. Like, she was a member of the so-called Tortured Poets Department.
No, it's the name. It's the title for her new album.
It's just funny because it sounds like she wants it to be Dead Poet Society so badly, but she can't make it that, so she has to change two of the
words. I know, it's such a weird, it does not roll off the tongue, but you know what? I am going to listen to it when it comes out, because as much, I'm going to,
such is the grunt work of a,
I'm just gonna go back to being Swift, like a life. Kind of private Swiftie. I'm not gonna be sharing that journey with you guys anymore. So, I'm embarrassed.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final time you will ever hear Hannah speak about Taylor Swift publicly again.
I can't promise that. She's everywhere. I can't promise that.
What do you think Hillary Clinton watches on like a weeknight?
That's actually a really important question. Wouldn't it be so great if she watched Housewives?
Hillary Clinton does not have joy in her soul. I don't think she watches Housewives.
I know, but wouldn't it be great if she did?
No, it wouldn't be great if she did. I don't want her to watch things I like.
I just think it would be funny.
Would it? Like, who do you think she would like on Housewives?
Well, it depends on the show. I don't know. Maybe she would love Kyle.
She would like Bethany Frankel.
Girl boss.
Girl boss.
But anyways, this isn't a podcast about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, as much as you guys probably want it to be.
No, I'm sorry. Maybe down the line.
What this podcast is about, however, is the internet and what we think about it.
Yeah, not you, Hillary.
It's not Hillary Rehash.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Maya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the social media phenomena, not phenomenons, as we've been told.
We are illiterate.
Honestly, us saying social media phenomenons has become a social media phenomenon.
Yeah.
As in, we've gotten like 2 Instagram comments about it.
And we are 2 social media phenomenons ourselves.
Well, yes. Social media phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. And this season, friends, is a loose, no pun intended, history of sex on the internet, the symbiosis of our 2 most basic instincts, innovation and getting off. So if you have kids in the car, tell them to put on their headphones and watch Paw Patrol. If you like our show and would like to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we have bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. And if you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that helps a lot. Today's episode, like most of the topics we will cover this season, is a story about the 4 most important things in North American culture.
Ooh, tell me.
Technology, celebrity, money, and sex. We are talking about the Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee sex tape. So a major theme for this season is how sex has helped with the advancement of technology and how that in turn has changed the culture around sex. And the consumption of erotic materials has always been like a major part of that dynamic. So, for example, in the 1970s, there was porno chic, which was like when feature-length adult films like Deep Throat would end up playing in non-adult theaters, and they were sort of the subject of mainstream discourse. And so I wanted to start this episode off with a question for you about that, because you made a video that touched on porno chic. And in that instance, I just wanted to know if you saw like a correlation between the ways that the porn was being shown and like consumed and the sexual politics of the time. I've been thinking about like how, you know, the viewing experience of like treating porn almost like a cinematic experience and, you know, the kinds of plots and stories and like fantasy that had to go into creating it. If that was speaking to the ways that people were willing to kind of think and talk about sex culturally.
Ooh, interesting. Well, I think a huge theme that we're going to be seeing this season is like, does sex influence culture? Does culture influence sex? And like, does technology influence culture? Does culture influence technology? Like, it's always kind of a chicken and egg question. And I think with porno chic, I mean, this was a time financially where the porn industry had a lot of money and was able to make these kind of like narrative features that had these like intricate plot lines and actual acting. Whether that acting was good is obviously ever questioned, but you know, like full drawn out movies, feature length movies. And I think a lot of that has to do with just 1, the financing, but then 2, you know, there's a supply and demand. So also the demand, which I think was kind of a byproduct of the sexual revolution.
Yeah.
Like the late 60s.
And do you think there was sex and like eroticism felt kind of maybe a more high cultured approach to it? Like we kind of, it was more romantic maybe. I mean, I don't know, not that the films were romantic, but our conceptions of those things.
Well, Porno Chic also, a huge thing about it was that it was very mainstream. Like a lot of famous celebrities admitted to watching porn would attend the premieres of these porno movies. I think like a huge amount of celebrities attended the premiere of Deep Throat, which is insane. Like celebrities were able to kind of be open about their consumption of it. And so it gave porn this kind of, this elevated aspect to it. You're right, like a high culture aspect. That's where it gets like the chic name. Yeah. Because it was the kind of thing where these movies were then being kind of talked about in like intellectual high culture salon. Like if you went to someone's dinner party in the Upper East Side, they'd be talking about a movie like Deep Throat, for example.
Yeah, and like Kubrick, there's that famous anecdote about Kubrick wanting to make like a high culture blue movie, basically.
Well, yeah, and Andy Warhol's Blue Movie also kind of, which is one of the first like erotic films that I wouldn't say was mainstream, but one of the first like I think it was a feature length film to be made that was defined as an erotic film, that gave way to kind of also a mainstreaming of like sex in film, because you were seeing like Last Tango in Paris come out soon after that, and like you're saying, Kubrick saying he wants to make his own Blue Movie. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, because I really want to make that distinction, because moving forward in the like 80s and the 90s, I think the ability to rent porn on video, which no doubt helped with the popularity of VHS players in the home and a boom in the adult film industry, also kind of maybe brought down the cultural cachet of porn and like adult films, which then like leads to now, but starting in the 90s, which is where the ability to consume that porn without, you know, even the embarrassment of going to an adult video store, like within the privacy of your own home, just find it on the internet. Like it just probably brought a lot of people to the internet as well.
Well, totally. I think individualizing the consumption of porn removes the culture aspect. Like it removes the kind of communal viewing experience of watching it. And I think any instance where some sort of product becomes available to the masses immediately lowers its cultural cachet. You're right.
It makes it like a private thing, like a private sphere thing. And I feel like there's less pressure to appeal to people's other sensibilities because you're not really masking the sex in something else. You're just watching it purely to get off.
When I was researching this video that I made about the anti-sex scene discourse, I noticed this kind of trend that was prevalent like in the history of porn, where when there's less accessibility to porn, we're more willing to see sex on our screens in films. But when there's more accessibility to porn, we're getting it all the time. So then when we're watching a movie, we're less tolerant of a sex scene. Like it has to have some sort of artistic justification for being there. And that's kind of what was happening when VHS hit and kind of killed the porn industry in that way, and like porno chic culture. People were like, okay, well, I can see this stuff at home, so why would I want my movies to have sex in it?
Yeah.
And that's when you see a steep decline in like actual sex in movies. It has to be like a Fatal Attraction kind of sex where it's like roped in with all of these like almost negative themes.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It's so fascinating to think about.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of leads me to my follow-up question, which is, do you think that the accessibility of porn through the VHS and then the internet has changed, you know, our relationship to it as audiences and also like the types of content that become popular?
Yeah. And we're going to get into this a lot in our next episode, but making the consumption of porn something, yeah, as you were saying, a private sphere act that you can be done in the home with your blinds closed, no one knows you're doing it, kind of turns the act into more of like an expedient form of sexual gratification. Like you're doing this to get your nut. You know, when you're sitting down to watch a movie with your friends on a TV, you're sitting down for both the experience of doing this with your friends and for watching the film. So it's a completely different experience versus like sitting on your laptop, I don't know, with some lotion, you know, underneath your bed sheets is a completely different approach to the product that you're watching. So I think totally it would change what you're watching because you don't have to be like ashamed and you can skip to the good parts.
Yeah.
You know?
I asked this because a surprising thing that came up like while researching this story is the idea of mundanity, because it seems like when porn went from being like a cinematic experience to something you could watch or make at home, it changed as a genre from being about like fantasies to being about realism. And I think it's really exemplified in the way people will talk about the tape. But we'll come back to that. So we're going to kind of begin our story by talking about a different adult industry, which is phone sex. So in the 1990s, legislative restrictions started being put on phone sex operators in the United States. And at this time, we see the internet becoming more widely accessible and more popular in people's homes, which leads to a lot of the big names in the phone sex industry moving online. And what happens is, like, basically the invention of camming. So these people will take the interactivity of a phone call and incorporate live streamed video where performers respond to the requests and, like, comments of viewers. It's so interesting to think about because the people behind these websites, like, ended up innovating and contributing to a lot of the technology we take for granted now.
Ooh.
So, like, the ability to receive credit card payments, you know, to stream quality videos, certain graphic design features. Like, there was a lot of freedom and, like, money in this kind of sphere that, like, really sphere that led to people in the adult industry basically pioneering a lot of the internet. And one of those pioneer figures was this wonder kid named Seth Warshawski. Warshawski.
That is such a wonder kid name.
He is such a classic, like, tech prodigy.
And that dickhead. Kid was Jimmy Neutron.
I mean, okay, but when I say kid, I mean kid, because he drops out of high school at only 17 and decides to start what ends up becoming, like, quite a successful phone sex company with his friend.
Honestly, wow, that guy must have been the coolest guy of all his friends.
Or
a fucking nerd.
I think you have to be if we've learned anything from Mark Zuckerberg, that you have to be kind of weird.
I know, but it's a really short pipeline between a nerd genius to coolest guy ever these days.
Yeah, and I think this guy definitely probably had a heyday of feeling like the coolest guy ever.
Oh, totally.
Because by the mid-90s, he's the founder of the Internet Entertainment Group, which oversees, like, numerous adult websites, including their flagship site, Club Love. So he's literally in his early to mid-20s, and IEG is really, they're very successful because they not only make content that they put on their own websites, but they, like, make stuff that gets kind of wholesale bought by companies like Penthouse that have higher viewership rates. So this kid's kind of, like, tapped into this market. And IEG mostly does, like, live peep shows, and a lot of them are filmed in this warehouse that he's converted into a studio, I think, in Seattle. Yeah. And they would have, like, 24/7 live streaming, and they'd have different sets, and the girls would be there overseen by, like, this kind of house mother almost. And it sounded, learning about it was fascinating. It's not really clear how much money they were bringing in at their peak, because, like, later scandals suggest that they were maybe cooking their books. But it sounds like they were, like, a pretty profitable company at some point. And Warshawski even made Time Magazine's 50 Most Important Figures in Technology.
I mean,
in 99.
People got to get their nut.
I mean.
And he's giving the people what they need.
Where's his biopic?
I don't want one.
No, he definitely sucks. So now we're going to step away from Seth and IEG, and we're going to meet our main characters, which is Pam and Tommy.
The real ones, not Lily James and
Sebastian Stan. No, Pamela Anderson and Tommy Lee. And they meet on New Year's of 1995. A month later, Tommy follows Pam to Mexico, and the two begin a four-day whirlwind affair that ends with them getting married on the beach.
What is love plays overhead?
Is that in the show?
They have, like, them meeting in the club. They're playing, like, every 90s club song you can think of. And I think it's What is Love. Anyways, I'm going to get married to that song, too.
Oh, my God. I can't wait. So, I mean, we're familiar with Pam and Tommy, especially if you have seen the show. They've had a resurgence as cultural figures. A lot of people have been dressing as them for Halloween, you know. But to just kind of give everyone a refresh, Pamela Anderson is, like, the prototypical blonde bombshell of the 1990s. She's a household name for her role on Baywatch, which I learned was the most popular show of the 90s.
I'm so shocked you didn't know that.
No, I didn't realize a billion people worldwide turned in to watch it.
Babe, the power of a slow motion boobs is unparalleled.
it's kind of amazing. It's beautiful. I didn't know that Baywatch had the pull that it did. But yeah, she was a sex symbol from that, and for her previous work as a Playboy playmate, she's appeared on the cover of Playboy more than any other person.
Oh.
She recently disclosed in her documentary, Pamela, A Love Story, that she had a history with, like, sexual abuse and rape as a child, which led to her being, you know, a more shy and reserved teenager. But she actually credits posing nude for Playboy with, like, bringing her out of her shell.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of criticisms about Playboy, but it seems like it was a positive experience for her. In her time as a public figure, she's been very candid about her sex life and, like, her boob job, and interviewers feel very comfortable asking her about those things. It's insane.
Well, even, like, growing up, Pamela Anderson, you know, we didn't grow up with her on Baywatch. We were later. We were younger. And growing up, like, she was just synonymous with big, fake boobs. Like, that was her entire shtick, basically, at least to us, like, as we understood her.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I know. And she's even joked about how, like, you know, her boobs had a career and she just tagged along. Like, she's very aware of that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I grew up mostly knowing Pam for, like, Borat. There's a big joke about her in Borat. And as a sort of mocked, trashy tabloid person who would be married to, like, Kid Rock and stuff. So, yeah, I just didn't know how famous she was in the 90s until researching this.
Wow, really? Yeah. I'm so shocked.
Just so you knew about her.
Yeah, more. I knew she was, like, really famous. Like, I knew she was from Baywatch and stuff.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I guess a blind spot. I did not know about Baywatch in this way. And then Tommy was the drummer for heavy metal band Motley Crue. I don't think I know a single Motley Crue song.
I, like, had a bunch of their music on my iPod shuffle growing up that I listened to, but I can't remember any of it. But they were huge when they were huge.
Yeah. We literally don't know if I would recognize one of them. Maybe I would.
No, I don't think so.
No. So the band is mostly known for their flashy presentation and substance abuse. Tommy struggles with alcohol addiction throughout his marriage to Pam. I watched this, like, MTV little half-hour documentary about him, and he has the craziest energy, at least, like, on camera.
It's terrible energy, but also kind of...
You get
vibly.
It. You can see why he would charm somebody. He's kind of insane.
He's got a rock star aura.
Yes. Definitely just, like, embodies the idea of what rock star.
Well, especially from his era of rock, which is like 80s glam, right? Pre-Nirvana. Yeah. Like, the, you know, people always talk about the kind of clashing of Axl Rose and Kurt Cobain. And he really is of the Axl Rose camp of misogynist rock star, crazy, druggy womanizer.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like all of Motley Crue maybe was.
At least they did the thing, you know?
Yeah. You know what? Commit.
Yeah, commit.
So both Pam and Tommy had high-profile relationships in the past. Tommy was, like, married to Heather Locklear, and Pam had dated, like, a string of famous men. I think they were both in relationships when they met.
Honestly, every power couple gets together in that way, and honestly, that's my toxic thought of the week.
Yeah.
That's been actually my toxic thought of the past, like, year.
We should all be in unsatisfactory relationships so that we can meet our soulmates.
Well, yeah, half my friend's parents, I swear, got together in, like, sketchy ways like
that. Okay, and call them out.
And we're calling them out one by one.
So when they get together, of course, it's immediately tabloid fodder. And as newlyweds, Pam and Tommy were constantly documenting their lives on High 8 videotapes. And this is very typical behavior for, like, a young family in the 1990s. I recently got a bunch of old High 8 tapes digitized from when I was, like, a baby and when my parents were young.
My uncle, like, 10 years ago, I think. No, way over 10 years ago. He actually managed to digitize every tape that we had made over the past. No, I guess they were already digital, a lot of them. But, like, he managed to get them all into these, like, files for us. So then we spent, like, 4 years kind of getting together as a family and, like, watching all the tapes from... Aww. When we were little, yeah, so.
And it really does take
They're iconic.
It takes that long to watch through it because people will film stuff for so long.
Oh, my aunt was notorious for whenever we went on vacation. We went to the Dominican, I guess, a couple times. Yeah, when I would have been like 2 or 3. And she just films the sky. Straight up the sky. Like, and she gets distracted too, so she's filming while she's talking to someone, and it's just like filming the pavement for about 20 minutes. It's awesome.
Yeah, we have footage of like us opening presents on Christmas for half an hour that is fascinating for us to watch, but like as a tape is so boring
because it's made for family consumption and like nostalgia and remembering. Yeah. You know, so
yeah, exactly.
Bring them back because I'm concerned we're gonna lose a lot of memories. iPhones look like shit, and I'll say it now.
And also, we end our videos so quickly. A lot of people were filming a lot of their lives on High 8 tapes, but Pam and Tommy being Pam and Tommy took it a step further and documented everything. So on one particular tape from their honeymoon period, between like house tours and fishing trips, they filmed themselves engaging in like various sex acts, often in public spaces, like let's pull over the car on the side of the road so we can have sex.
As any couple with a good sex life will know.
Yeah.
Spice it up.
Spice it up. They were definitely a spicy duo, for sure.
If there's any couple with a sex life, it was those two.
Yeah. And it's likely the explicit nature of this particular tape that motivated them to keep it in a safe, along with like Tommy's guns and Pam's jewels. But this would prove to be an infamous mistake.
Who would have thunk, though? Because, you know, you think safe and you think, well, I'm safe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that they were thinking logically.
Sometimes your libido trumps logic, I guess, or something. Money. Sometimes money trumps logic.
Money trumps everything.
Money does make the world go round.
Money is the anthem of success. In January of 1996, Pam and Tommy noticed that this safe is missing. And in fact, it was stolen 3 months earlier by an electrician and adult entertainer named Rand Gauthier.
Also known as Seth Rogen.
Also known as Seth Rogen himself. In 1995, Seth Rogen was fired as a contractor by Tommy.
Rand Gauthier.
Yeah, Rand Gauthier was fired as a contractor by Tommy, who he says also held him at gunpoint and still owed him like $20,000. Knowing there are valuables kept in their safe, he decides to break into their home and steal it. And he breaks into their home by covering himself in yak fur and pretending to be their dog.
Wait, what?
Yeah, it's in the show.
It's in the show?
So he installed their security cameras and like knew that it wouldn't pick up that high quality of an image. So to get undetected onto their property, he covers himself in yak fur and like crawls like a dog. Or so he says. He also says he did this all on his own and there was evidence to point to the contrary. So it's like,
yeah,
we're taking his word for it, but this is how he tells the story.
He was like, this is the only logical way.
Well, because
this is the only way.
Remember, it's a story about innovation. So when Gauthier finds the tape, he brings it to porn studio boss Milton Ingley, otherwise known as Nick Offerman. The two shop the tape around to different porn distributors, but since it was clearly stolen, nobody wants to buy it. But mafioso and porn producer Louis Pierino puts up $50,000 so that the pair can like sell the tape directly to the consumers via the internet.
He was like, we gotta get this to the people.
Yeah.
The people need to see this.
And they were like, this is the future. I see the future.
He was like, this is the bedrock of democracy. The people need to know.
Yeah. And with this is what Etsy is built on. E-commerce.
Yeah.
And while this seems like an innovative solution, this ends up backfiring on them. Because tapes are really easy to copy. And Gauthier and Ingley had no copyright over their stolen material. So bootleggers start selling their own copies and Penthouse magazine even tries to like pay Pam and Tommy for the rights to it. It's a whole like legal thing, but in 1997, Ingley is ordered to stop selling the tapes. However, at this point, there's like too many bootleg copies that it doesn't even matter. And this is when Seth Warshawski steps in. Just thinking about this, it made me feel really disturbed to think about something as like private and intimate as like a home video being something that could be subject to copyright. Does that spook you out a little?
I mean, intellectual property, it will come for us all.
I guess everything is intellectual property.
Well, yeah, when you're in America, you can sue anyone and you can patent anything.
So in November of 1997, Warshawski streams the Pam and Tommy tape on loop for 5 hours. And Pam and Tommy file a lawsuit against him, but they end up settling. And the settlement basically gives him, like, full rights to the tape. They claim that there was a misunderstanding, and they thought they were only giving him the ability to share the video online, which, like, at the time, they didn't realize how big of a deal that was because they were like, the internet. But the settlement actually allowed him to make deals with porn distribution companies to like legally sell hard copies of the tape in stores, as well as distributing it online. And there seems to be like debate about whether or not the settlement included Pam and Tommy getting a cut. But they both insist that they've seen no money from the tapes. And they also say they chose to settle because Pam was pregnant and like she'd had a history of miscarriage and they didn't want the stress to like induce another one. But so now the tape, which with all of the court coverage has become like the subject of a lot of buzz, is now available for anybody to watch. And through this, it sort of becomes like a water cooler moment. Like it's something that you might see not for like sexual reasons, but even just to know what people are talking about. It's like I watched the Vanderpump Rules Scandoval season because I wanted to know what people were talking about, but I wasn't like following the show.
It's to get a leg in on the conversation. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you just don't want to be, no one wants to be left out. And that's what the story's about.
No, like I still don't know how Succession ends and I feel left out.
Girl, well, that is on you.
It is on me. And this is where we return to like our discussion around porn and mundanity, because sex actually only makes up 8 of the tape's 54 minutes. The rest of the tape is like really typical home video stuff. And so I just wanted to ask you, like, why do you think we have such an obsession with celebrity sex tapes, even if the contents are like relatively mundane? Like, why do you think that this would become such a popular thing?
Well, that's so funny because I was just watching Mina Lay's video about like Architectural Digest home tours, and she kind of talks about this idea, but just we're just nosy and we just want to know what's going on in like the homes of aspirational people. What are they up to? I think someone would watch Pamela Anderson pick her nose if they could, because they're just like, how would Pamela Anderson do it? Like, there's this cult of personality around celebrities that you just want to know how this specific person lives and breathes. I mean, it's like celebrity fetishism in the way that like commodity fetishism is a thing, where you're like, this object has spiritual value, in the same way that like a celebrity is just an every other human being, but they have a spiritual value around them. And so to watch Pamela Anderson opening her fridge is this spiritual moment. It's like, how does Pamela Anderson grip the fridge and open it? You know, how does she do that? Because she's special.
And when it also kind of dances a line between like performative and your public facing self and your private facing self, because yes, you're in your home and you're being you, you're not playing a character, but you're still presenting a version of yourself. And totally. I think with this tape, even more than a home video tour does, is show them, I mean, they're still performing to a degree, but they're off guard.
Well, exactly. Like Mina in the video talks about how Jackie Kennedy's home tour, which she says is one of the first home tours, when it was advertised in like Time magazine or something, Jackie Kennedy's hair is kind of disheveled and she doesn't have a lot of makeup on and she's wearing a turtleneck. So people thought that the video was going to be kind of like raw and authentic. And then it ends up being this video where she's like in this special kind of like, I think she's wearing like a pillbox hat or something. And she's like kind of walking around her apartment stiffly and it's, or not the apartment, the White House suite, kind of stiffly and awkwardly. And it just wasn't what people were expecting almost. And that's kind of the same here. Like, yeah, when you watch an Architectural Digest tour, you're like, okay.
Or those Vogue 73 question things.
Yeah, there's such artifice that people kind of check out. Yeah, whereas this is like actually raw and authentic. Another thing is just that the public is voyeuristic. We're peeping toms. Like, we just want to peep into something. There's literally an entire category of porn called voyeur porn. And this is basically that. Like, you're watching these amateurs.
Yes. Buglies. Right. And I was going to ask you, like, do you think that like people's draw to this tape was primarily erotic or was an extension of voyeurism?
I think it's definitely an extension of voyeurism. I think maybe for, you know, like Pamela Anderson was a bombshell and a sex symbol. And so obviously a lot of like men and boys and young guys all want to get off to Pam Anderson. And like they're tuning into Baywatch to watch her. Now they get to watch her fully unclothed. It's like, obviously there's some sexual gratification element. But then of course it's just like, I'm sure a lot of women watched it. I mean, sorry, this is a very heterosexual interpretation of this. But, like, I'm sure a lot of straight women probably also tuned in because they're like, well, what's Pam up to?
Well, because you could also see Pamela Anderson naked in Playboy.
That's true. Right?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the both. But I think the voyeurism was really heavy when you consider the ratio of, like, sex to regular activities in the tape. Amanda Chicago, whose 2014 article on the scandal for Rolling Stone was the basis of Pam and Tommy, the TV show, she also thinks it's voyeurism. She said, it wasn't the first time a video of a famous person fornicating appeared in the public realm, and it certainly wouldn't be the last, but it was a porno that appealed to people who didn't usually watch pornos, a voyeuristic dive into the guileless intimacy between two tabloid darlings.
That makes a ton of sense. Also, it's like, you just want to see, like, what does their home look like? Where do they vacation?
Well, yeah, they're on a yacht in a lot of it. Or, like, a boat.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there's a lot of discussions in academia at the time about, like, how to define the tape genre-wise. So, for example, in his essay, Pamela Anderson in The Slippery Slope, Chuck Kleinhans situates the tape within the genre of gonzo pornography, foreshadowing our next episode. But it was interesting when you talked about voyeurism pornography, because I do think it's a little bit of both. I don't think this tape is strictly gonzo, because that's not really the situation that's taking place.
Well, it's just a real life tape, yeah.
It's a real life tape. But I think it appeals to the same kind of viewer base. So gonzo pornography is like when what is usually a male performer is also like the cameraman and his partner is a so-called amateur, usually not actually, but it gives the idea that this situation just started happening.
Just happened, yeah.
Yeah, and he had his camcorder on it.
And it's like, it's professionally made still. Yeah.
And it's interesting to think about it in terms of being a porno, because there's also question about whether you could even classify the tape as pornography. So in the anthology Porn Studies, Minette Hillier points out that even though the video is called porn and distributed as such, it did begin its life as a home video. And she brought up a lot of like interesting kind of like similarities and differences between porn and home videos as genres. She says that they both show facsimiles of intimacy and revelation, but that they seem to ease access to those things most fundamental to our humanity. You know, there's like a real kind of vulnerability about them. They're like showing us something about ourselves. But she also says that they're often taken as radically incompatible, both in their social purpose and their circulation as cultural products. And then she asks, how do we account for the generic slippage or transformation, the quote, porning, that this footage seems to undergo in its passage from the safe in the garage to hundreds of thousands of video stores and websites? How do we negotiate the hierarchies of genre, spectatorship, and even truth engaged when these two different cultural products with very different social lives are conflated?
That's so fascinating.
I wanted to pose that question to you.
That's a great question. I mean, I think what the Pamela Anderson documentary remarks upon a lot, or like really tries to at least frame to us, is that there's kind of like a really beautiful tenderness to the videos. Like, mm-hmm. You're watching these two people in love with each other. They're so excited about each other. Say what you want about Tommy Lee, but like, he was very much in love with Pamela Anderson. And I think the beginning of their relationship was awesome. Like, they were very in love. They were very happy during this specific time. And there's something, yeah, like you were saying, vulnerable and beautiful about that. Like, it's not just sex in these videos. It is love. And some of that gets violated and, you know, perverted and like trespassed upon when it's then, you know, exploited for profit, for the profit of people who weren't even involved in it. You know what I mean? And the way that it then gets like marketed, the sex tape itself is a sex tape. But then when you couch that sex tape in like the framing of a poster and you're like, Pam Anderson naked, getting raw dogged here. Like, it's like, it just completely destroys any sort of tenderness to the film. And I think like when I think about porn, or like when I've talked about it to people, I feel like sex is a very, I'm probably not even using this word correctly, but I've always said it this way, like a very phenomenological experience. It's like a very embodied experience. So much of sex is what happens before sex, what happens after sex, like the lead up to it psychologically. So much of it is how you're interacting with the person, the having sex with you. Like, it's a very psychological experience. And I think porn completely takes that away. It's made for screen. So like, you know, if I were to see, if we're talking about heterosexual porn, like a penis going into a vagina, to me, that's not sex, because that's not what sex represents to me. And I think that kind of plays into this, like taking this act of lovemaking, turning it into an exploited like product to be then sold for other people's gratification. Like, there is something that gets lost, and I think it's the love.
And I think it's just interesting then when you think about like what we were talking about earlier, which is the transformation of porn as being, yes, an erotic experience, but also cinematic, also like having a cultural impact and like a certain romanticism to it as an idea, versus becoming something that is just about instant gratification. And then when you think about this tape, which is like, yeah, there's a tenderness, there's a sweetness to it, I think probably made with the objective of being romantic, capturing their love, not about capturing their sex, then becoming marketed, yeah, and turned into a pornographic product. Like, it's a similar transformation that takes place.
Of course, yeah. And I think with narrative porn, like porn, I love calling it narrative porn, but like narrative porn, porno chic, so much of the allure to that. Like, you know, I've seen a few of these 70s films and I think they're awesome because, again, like I'm saying, sex is the before and the after. It's the lead up. It's the relationship. It's all these things. It doesn't have to be, but to me, that's what it is, at least. To me, sex is not just the act. I think it's many things. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to give one definition of sex, but that's what those films are at least attempting to mimic or capture that gets lost with gonzo journalism.
Journalism? Thanks, Hunter S. Thompson.
We read. Just kidding. Gonzo porn.
No, exactly. And I think without the kind of invention of the technologies that would make it so easy to access porn at home, would the Pam and Tommy tape be looked at in the same way? Maybe, but it's just changed our mindset about how we think about things that contain sex in them.
Totally.
And then Hillier then poses the idea that Anderson's reputation as a sex symbol could make anything she does a matter of prurient interest, erotic. And she wonders if our willingness to call the tape, which again does not contain that much sex and wasn't filmed with the intentions of being pornographic, does that mean that a life, or at least a public life, can be pornographic?
I mean, no. I think Pamela's public exterior, like talking about bombshells, which I'm sure we'll get into, but bombshells like Marilyn Monroe, bombshells throughout history, we know that these women are a constructed identity. Like, they're constructed for a certain gaze. They're playing into it. It's a performance. So Pamela's performance in the public sphere is not the same as what she is doing in the private sphere. I think Pamela has been very clear about that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is trying to kind of, not saying this writer, but I think the conflation of her sex tape as pornography makes it seem like Pamela at all times is performing for us, and that she has no private life and that she has no personal interests that aren't for anyone else's benefit. And I think that's a dangerous conflation.
No, absolutely. And I agree. And I think it highlights the ways in which, like, Pam and Tommy's public images, particularly Pam's, were used to not only victim blame, but like justify the exploitation of the tape. Because it's almost like we have a right to see it as the public because of who they are.
Well, it's like, okay, not to do this again, but on Real Housewives, when Denise Richards is on it, Denise Richards, famous sex symbol from the 90s, very similar to Pamela Anderson in the way that she was marketed. There's this whole thing with the women on the season where Denise doesn't want them to talk about sex in front of, this is back in 2019, she doesn't want people to talk about sex very openly in front of her kids. And they're like, well, Denise, your kids have probably seen your sex scenes. You're a sex symbol. Yeah. So they've probably been exposed to it already. So actually, you don't have any right to think that your kids should have privacy, like should have a boundary between sex and their childhoods, basically. And it's like, again, a really dangerous and malicious conflation.
Yeah, it's like, because you performed, in these cases, not even real sex on a screen, you've sold your right to your own privacy, I suppose.
And like, we can say whatever we want about Denise Richards' parenting, but like, if she her kids before they turn the age of 18, she does not, as a mother, want them to hear her friends talking about threesomes in front of them. She should have that right.
No,
and I think the same with Pamela. If Pamela wants to have sex privately, she should have the right to do so. No one else is entitled to see it.
Yeah, if she wants to have sex privately and film it, she has the right to do so.
Totally.
Yeah. Also, what we were saying about Pam as like sort of a sex symbol and what she means, she was sometimes called the Marilyn Monroe of the 90s. And this idea was the subject of an essay by Chuck Klosterman in his book Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, A Low Culture Manifesto. That is such an early aughts book. The essay is super misogynistic to both Pamela and Marilyn, but I do think it provides an insight into public opinion at the time. Because he points out that, like, beyond being bodacious blondes, you know, what they have in common is the way that we project symbolic significance onto them. So he wrote, looking at the life of Pam Anderson in the present tense tells us as much about ourselves as looking back on Marilyn Monroe tells us about our fathers and mothers. In our cases, grandparents, probably. But what Klosterman thinks about Pam and what she says is that she is a mainstream, non-subversive porn star who actually does all the dirty things her disciples fantasize about. Marilyn Monroe was the perfect vessel for an age where it was wrong to want wild, easy sex. Pam is the perfect vessel in an age where not wanting wild, easy sex makes you a puritanical, born-again weirdo.
Oh, and, interesting.
I wanted to, like, know what you thought about his projections, but also, like, do you think that the icon status that's been given to these women makes us feel like an undeserved ownership over them?
Of what Pam says about the 90s. I mean, like, this is just a time when the cellutoid was becoming a thing. Like, the cellutoid, I think it's called, is when, like, real people were becoming celebrities. And I think Pam kind of occupies the in-between because she was a celebrity and she was in a show, but then she also didn't create a lot of material outside of that. So then she just became, like, a pop culture icon just as Pamela Anderson. And I think that, to me, is what she's so representative of, less than the sex. Like, I think it's more just that she's, like, Pam the person.
Well, it felt like she could never transcend her status.
Yeah.
Like, she tried to. She made Barbed Wire. That didn't work. And then she had a couple attempts at making other things, and it's just, like, you could never overshadow being this character.
Yeah, and I think it's a time when, like, TV finally started reaching film in terms of popularity, and the two started combining, and I think it was the perfect time for high and low culture to completely clash. And so we're seeing all these low culture figures becoming A-list celebrities. And I think when I think of the 90s and when I think of Pam, that's what I think of first, more than anything. In terms of sex, like, the 90s were insanely misogynistic. They hated women. I think Pam embodies the physical, like, the physical archetype of the ideal 90s sex symbol, like, in the way that today I think sex symbols have boobs, but it's more like they have huge asses. Like, that's kind of the thing. And back then it was like no butt, huge boobs, you know? So, like, I think in many ways, like, she represents the 90s in a physical way and also in a low culture celeb kind of way. What do you think she represents of the 90s?
Well, no, I think similarly. I mean, in the essay, he also talks about how basically, like, she is someone almost that we love to hate. Like, you don't want to admit you're attracted to her or you want to look like her, but you do. But it's really easy to talk about how much you hate her because she kind of, like, unabashedly does the things that you think are something worth hating a woman for, right? So if we think about the 90s as sort of like a cynical time, also it, like, makes sense that the sex symbol would be this person that, yes, makes people horny, but also makes people, like, spiteful.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think she very much embodied that.
Do we think that this icon status gives us a sense of ownership over figures like Pam and Marilyn, which we kind of talked about earlier, but...
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think we try to shape their narratives and shape who they are to suit our current cultural interests. The reason I hate the Pam and Tommy show is because, you know, they have Pamela Anderson circa 1999 monologuing about feminism and, like, women's rights. And it's like, I don't think Pamela Anderson was interested in that at the time. I'm sure she was feeling all the feelings of being exploited, but I don't think Pamela Anderson was walking around waxing on about feminism. And I think us trying to make her out to be this feminist figure is just to serve our own current day interests. And I don't think it necessarily benefits Pamela Anderson that much. I think it benefits Pamela Anderson's renaissance, but it's not going to get her back all those years where we treated her like shit, you know?
No, and I also think that it misrepresents the way that she was not at all backed or supported by feminism during this time, where it's like to link her to feminism when it's like she was
hated by feminists.
Well, yeah, she was basically treated as like the death knell of third wave feminism. She would be lumped up with stuff like Girls Gone Wild and like sleaze culture.
And she was part of it. Like, it's our attempts to kind of make Pamela Anderson prestige is like, no, she was very much taking part in that culture, you know?
Yeah. But it also doesn't mean that she shouldn't have, like, had people advocating on her behalf when this horrible invasion of privacy.
No, it absolutely doesn't mean she should have been exploited in any way or treated like she's a human being.
But I think, you know, people across the board maybe took joy in seeing her in this way that, like, maybe to them confirmed something about her.
Of course. Like, it was this time where women were maligned. It's just the simultaneous wanting a woman and then also shaming her for being so openly sexual. It's like going to jerk off to her at nighttime, but then during the daytime telling your friends that you think she's a whore. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But going back to, you know, this idea of, like, Klosterman just basically keeps asserting that Pamela represents everything America hates about itself and how, as a man, he's embarrassed to be attracted to her because it's, like, kind of uncool and low culture and, like, you'd want to be attracted to someone like Kate Moss or, like, someone who doesn't signify this very specific thing, but how he still is attracted to her. And I guess it's brought into mind conversations about people being embarrassed for, I guess, like what they're attracted to or who, or well, like
it's like a mini show we did about Kylie and Timothy Chalamet. It's yeah. like the men, we asked a bunch of men we knew if they were attracted to Kylie Jenner, and a lot of them were like, yeah. But it's like, and we were shocked because we didn't realize, and I think it was probably the same back then. You almost don't want to find out that, like, the men you know, they like boobs, they like blondes, and they like butts, and that's actually all they want, and that probably is the truth, but we women don't want to hear it, you know.
Probably, again, like, meant that Pamela didn't really have women in her corner in a time when, like, I would hope that today, in under similar circumstances, she would find that support from women or, like, some empathy. But, of course, I just think that because of who she was, it was not going to happen. Despite the fact that what happened was crime, a theft. It was like there's no ambiguity about that.
I think she would, and we'll find out why, but like I think she would absolutely have support from the public now.
Yes,
but yeah, I think our culture just we're just very self-righteous when we redeem these women. We're like, yeah, well, I loved her all along, and it's like, no, you fucking didn't. No. I remember being like, ew, Pamela Anderson, when I was some boy would bring her up. I mean, I was a kid, to be fair to me, but the culture one was a very mean-spirited culture in the 2000s, but also hated women.
Yeah,
we hated women, and that's just a fact that we have to reckon with and accept and treat them better going forward, but not try to make ourselves seem like we're any better.
No, exactly. We've kind of already expressed our feelings about the Pam and Tommy TV show. I didn't even finish it. I was like, this is fucking stupid. I did get to the feminism speech and was like, I knew before watching, like, I didn't want to watch it when it came out because I was like, I'm so sick of this weird bimbo redemption industrial complex that it's like, I think we're big fans of Sarah Marshall and you're wrong about. She kind of, I think, helped move this trend along, and she does it in a way that feels so genuine and like full and of Michael empathy Hobbs. And Michael Hobbs. And they're not exploiting these women's stories, but like things like the Pam and Tommy show absolutely are, in this weird, misguided, like fake feminism.
Well, do you think like executives at these streaming companies or whatever actually care about Pamela Anderson? No, it's a trend to redeem maligned women from the 90s. So they're like, okay, let's hop on the trend. Let's redeem Pam. Let's talk about how the culture was so mean to her and how we didn't take part in it. And we're also going to make it a feminist story in the most obvious way possible. I'll say, I think the acting on it's good, and I liked the talking dick. Tommy Lee's dick talks to him in the show, and I thought it was hilarious.
But I'm pretty sure they took that from his memoir, where his dick talks to him. It's like a lame character in his memoir.
Oh, that's funny. I mean, I'm just glad they did it. I felt like a risk, you know, and I was like, good for you. But other than that, it's just the most run-of-the-mill biopic miniseries.
It's by the people who did I, Tonya, and I think I, Tonya, like, it made more sense in that context to, like, redeem Tonya Harding in the way that they did.
They also didn't make her do any feminist speeches.
yeah, exactly.
I think I, Tonya is a good movie, but I think no biopic should ever be made after it, maybe. Like, stop.
Yes, Maya is the number one crusader against biopics.
I think they're terrible. Bob Marley biopic. Let's get ready. What's it called? Bob Marley One Love?
That's precisely what it's called.
So funny. Why would you call it that?
Because he does have a song where they say that.
It's like, I don't want my movie to be conflated with Lifetime movies, but I will call this movie Bob Marley One Love.
Love. So what talking, like thinking about the Pam and Tommy show kind of leads me to wonder about is obviously having a leaked sex tape and being boiled down to a sex symbol is like a dehumanizing thing that she went through. But do you think that the pendulum has sort of swung too far in that she's been boiled down to a one-dimensional figure as a martyr, and we've sort of removed any texture or color to her as a person or her life?
Well, she's become an icon again. Like, all over Instagram, there are photos of her, people being like, I love Pam, people dressing up as her. And it's like, yes, whenever someone becomes a piece of iconography, they're going to lose the humanity in the process of becoming an icon. So, like, the same with Marilyn. Like, ever since Marilyn died, people have been sad for Marilyn Monroe. But no one actually gives a fuck about Marilyn Monroe. Like, all these years later, in that movie, Blonde still managed to get made, which is like the most disempowering film on earth. And it's like the same with Pam and Tommy. Like, Pamela wasn't consulted in the making of it, So in many ways, it's still exploiting her story. It's just exploiting it with like whatever is trendy now, which is feminism.
Yeah. And bringing it back up. So like people are talking about something that she probably would rather leave in the past. In 2016, after the Anthony Weiner like sexting scandal, like she co-wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, basically calling pornography a public hazard and like telling men to stop watching porn. And she, I don't think this has been something she's been talking about in recent years, so I don't know if this is still her stance.
That's very Linda Lovelace of her.
But it's like, yeah, maybe that kind of indicates that she doesn't really want to be associated with that anymore. Fair enough.
Well, she like had to make that documentary because she was like, I just want to tell my side of the story, but it's not like she was like, yay.
Well, she was making the documentary before I think the show was announced because it's a plot point in the documentary. But that's what I was also wondering, like, do you think it's at least better that, unlike Marilyn, you know, this is happening in Pam's lifetime, and so she has the opportunity to submit her side of things to kind of contradict certain narratives, to like assert things that Marilyn didn't get to do. We can only like pretend we know what's in her mind and how she feels about these events.
I mean, of course, first and foremost, it's just good she's not dead.
I mean, of course.
And didn't die at a young age. But also, yeah, of course, I think she now has the agency to tell her own story. But again, it's just like, even the Pam documentary, I was like, I like it, but it's, I don't know. I just think this renaissance is great and we should just start treating women better and like we should redeem these figures. But I think, I don't know, there just feels like something self-serving of the public side in doing the redemption. Like, there's just something about it is annoying. No. Not on her part, but just on the public's part.
Well, I think it's also like, okay, now that we can pity Pam Anderson, we deem her valuable enough to like show up in our popular culture again, right? And I think there's a real kind of hagsploitation thing going on that I think Ryan Murphy is somewhat responsible for. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's just like we're kind of becoming obsessed with like these women that have like we've either forgotten about them or we've done them wrong and we're kind of giving them new spotlights, but they have to continue like to play on those backstories that they've gone through. Yeah. Or like really play on the, I think, kind of the hagsploitation stereotypes. I think when I think about like Ryan Murphy products where he like has Jessica Lange always playing this kind of evil cunty older woman, mm-hmm. which is always fun to watch, but it's like this is the only time we're finding them valuable is either through that mindset or through a redeemed tragic figure mindset.
Yeah, we can't just treat them like people. Pamela Anderson's a human being. I don't know.
Yeah. So as far as like the legacy of the tape itself, I mean, it's obvious like we wouldn't have Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton without the tape. But what's also interesting to think about is like what both Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton did was they followed their tapes with reality TV shows that I think expanded on what we were talking about earlier about part of the appeal being the glimpse into the lives of these people. Even if their sex tapes are much more performative and like obviously leaked, I think that they figured out how to cash in on the thing that Pamela couldn't.
They're like, okay, you saw my sex tape, now you can see my home.
Yeah, exactly. Closing things off, I want to go back to the Minette Hillier essay, which it really did make me think about whether or not the obsession and fascination with this tape was predicting the inevitable popularity of vlogging, which you brought up earlier when talking about the Architectural Digest home tours. But like, do you think that this was sort of the ancestor of what we see now, which is returning to the idea of can a life be pornographic? I was thinking maybe pornographic doesn't necessarily have to mean erotic, right?
Just fetishized.
Yeah, fetishized. And if we watch like an Emma Chamberlain vlog where she's like, come with me to get like a cream cheese bagel, is there something pornographic about that?
Yeah, I think we get some sort of instant gratification from peeping. It's peeping. Like, I think vlogging is just peeping into someone's life. Like, it's playing into audiences' predilections for voyeurism. I think it can definitely be considered pornographic. I love the concept of using that word for other means. I also think, of course, Pam and Toby. Like, I think of definitely the sex tape is, like, the early ancestor. It's a home video that made its way to the internet and got circulated there.
Do you think that the popularity of internet porn has then played a role in taking that even further and kind of just like softening the lines?
People can film their own sex tapes at home and put them up. Like, there's a whole category of amateur porn, right? So like now you don't have to watch professionally made porn. You can just watch someone who filmed themselves having sex at home, and that can also be considered porn. So I think definitely it collapsed the boundaries, even though Pam and Tommy weren't consenting to doing that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think that maybe this kind of mundane trend of porn and the mundane ways that people watch it, like at home, has, you know, changed what we consider erotic? Like, has the internet changed eroticism?
Ooh, interesting. Just going off what I said earlier, I think eroticism is extremely entangled with psychology, and I think it's entangled with an embodied experience. So I think the internet has definitely collapsed that. I think we'll get into it more in the next episode. But I think stripping down the culture and the mindset around sex and making it just like sex, I think it definitely has kind of killed eroticism a bit and maybe displaced it into other areas, like you're saying, with vlogging.
So would you say video killed the porn star?
Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.